With good controls now.
Yeah, I mean, after I talked to you and Greg about it, which you guys won't have heard yet because we're doing this ass backwards, I went and played with it again last night, and the aiming, which I mentioned to you, is so smooth, and you can just get so fast at it.
Nice. That's cool. And have you figured out yet, does the cheese do anything?
I think it's there to feed the rats.
You think so? You think they went in and said, oh, okay, well, there are rats inside these fictional buildings, so
I'll tell you, cheese. Last night my satellite went out, so I really didn't have anything to do but sit around and think about this kind of shit. And, you know, the rat is in every video game. So, you know, I think
That's a good point.
I think it's a hunk of cheese for the rat.
So pixelated cheese for digital rats?
Yeah, or the other way around.
I gotcha.
Do pixel rats hunger for digital cheese?
I think Philip K. Dick had a similar question.
Did he?
But
he can't sue us anymore, though, so it's all good.
No. I don't think we have money, so.
Yeah, that's true, too. Okay. So this is the first episode of Sugar Rush, Game Sugar's podcast, maybe recurring. That'd be cool. I'm Jamie Love, and cutting in there is Michael Tucker.
Hello.
Take a bow, Tucker.
Oh, I had been already. You just can't see me.
Oh, well, there you go.
Of course. So, Jamie, what are we talking about?
This week we're going to get into a whole bunch of shit that I've been playing and putting time into, which is mostly Pokemon and Perfect Dark, and we're going to break it up into segments because I hear people like editing.
I heard that too. It's weird.
I don't know. I'd rather just have the big vortex of nonsense for 3 hours.
Y'all ready to get funky?
The most important part of dance is music. So now let us listen to the music and identify the beats.
One, two, three.
But that was too soft.
It was Red and Blue were the original ones, and then they released Yellow, which is pretty much the same thing. You just started out with Pikachu instead.
Right.
And then after those two, they released Gold and Silver, which was the first edition of new Pokemon. And then they recently, like a few years ago, re-released Red and Blue as like Fire Red and something
Leaf
Blue.
Green.
Leaf Green, that's it. That's right, you're right.
Because it was Red and Green in Japan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there was also a blue one, but that was kind of like y'all, how it was made afterwards. It's very complicated.
Well, you can school us in the podcast when we're recording.
It seems like one of those things everyone knows. Like, you try to tell everybody that Mario 2 was, like, a different game in Japan, and it seems, like, very repetitive. You know?
Yeah. Wait. You mean the Mario 2 we have isn't the original Mario 2? Lost Levels was Mario 2? You're blowing my mind, man.
So, I'm going to do a little intro, and it's time to talk about Pokemon, because I've suddenly found myself obsessed with it. I went through the trouble of getting a Pokemon expert. We have EarnTheInternet.com's Kaiatsuwa here. Say hello, Kat.
Hi. Sorry, it's my first podcast.
It's all right. It's Game Sugar's first podcast, so it's just going to be awkward as hell. But
awesome. It's our thing, I think. Yeah. The awkwardness.
Anyways, Tucker's been listening to me go on about the Poke Walker all week long, and that's why decided we're going to talk about Pokemon.
Well, you kind of decided. No one else really had a choice.
No, it got put to a vote.
Of just you, though.
Yeah, but it's still, it was democratic.
Democratic with the only people voting who matter. I gotcha. So I've been hearing with the Poke Walker, mainly from you, Jamie, but I guess you have some experience with it, Kat, that it's a pretty fun addition.
Yeah.
Did you have the original, I'm going to show my Pokemon ignorance, the device that was around before the Poke Walker that's sort of like it?
Oh, the Pikachu one?
Yeah.
That I had. Now, that was addictive to a younger fellow, a younger version of myself. So, but this, like, the Poke Walker actually has integration, though, with the actual game. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. You can transfer Pokemon over to it and carry them around in your pocket.
All right.
And yeah, my main addiction is that you can level them up.
Nice. Yeah, like, the Pikachu is... It was pretty addictive for, like, a younger, Pokefreak, such as myself. But it was pretty much useless. It was, like, a really a Pokemon-branded cheap Tamagotchi when it had no integration with the game itself.
So the Pokemon were just on it forever?
No, it was just a Pikachu on it. And, like, you had to feed it, and you could, like... shake it and play like a little roulette game to get like watts or something, I think.
Okay.
And then you could like give Pikachu gifts to make him happy. But if you forgot him, if like you didn't take care of him for a little while, he would run away and you'd have to start over. And
okay.
That always made me sad. But but it was the same concept though. It had a pedometer in it, and that's how you got wattage. You would walk with it, or if you were like me. And probably everyone else, you would just sit in a couch and shake it for a few hours.
Okay, well, that's the main thing with this one, because a lot of people thought that the pedometer in this Poke Walker was from their personal walker trainer games.
Yeah.
And I was pretty sure that the technology had existed long before, so thank you for confirming that.
Yeah, and they've been doing this for a little while. But so how's the integration with it work? Like, I mean, you were saying that... you can level up your Pokemon, but like, how does that work? You connect it to the game, and then, or is it wireless? Or
you want to take a stab at it, Kat?
Yeah, it's like an infrared thing, like the other one. Like, there's an infrared chip in the cartridge itself, actually, mm-hmm. that you hold up to the Pokewalker, and it can you can put Pokemon onto it.
Weird.
Through that.
See, the only I don't know how you feel about it, Kat. The only thing I found so far is that I really love this thing, but the way that they've laid out how you put Pokemon on it is like a little complicated, unnecessarily so.
Yeah. Also, another bad thing is like if a Pokemon levels up and it learns it's supposed to learn a move at that level, it doesn't learn it at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's making me really paranoid. Like whenever I load one up, I have to like check online to see if they're about to learn a move or not.
All right, I got a Heart Gold question for you, because I know nothing about the series, and this is the first time I've actually really committed to playing one through. When your Pokemon is evolving, I just happened to hit the buttons, and it stopped evolving. Did I stop that, or is that just the thing it does?
Yeah, if you press the B button, it stops it evolving.
Okay, because I thought that was the deal, but I wasn't completely sure if I was just hallucinating or not.
It's like if you tap B and like circle up and down really hard on the control pad, it makes it easier to catch Pokemon.
Hey, I believe that. Man, I always believe that too. But yeah, I mean, come on, Jamie, you should know this, how to stop your Pokemon from evolving. I learned that back in elementary school.
Man, so. I don't know what I was doing back then, but I just wasn't into the. I mean, Pokemon was everywhere, but I just wasn't playing them. I think it's because I didn't. Really?
Well, they also covered that in the TV show, you know. I mean, Ash in the first season, Ash didn't want Pikachu to evolve.
And that's why I thought maybe I was doing something, was because of the TV show. But I just wasn't big on handhelds back then.
That's like, how do you stop evolving? Like, actually, like, in the cartoon, do you just, like, push at them really hard, like, while they're just, like, evolving? Like, no, cut that out!
I really don't remember. I think Ash was just, like, started crying and talking to himself, and then Pikachu stopped evolving or something. I really don't remember.
It was like Pikachu evolves through a stone anyway, so you can't evolve it unless you choose to.
Was that how it is in the games, or?
Yeah, like some Pokemon evolve through stones. Like currently, you just touch a stone to it and it evolves.
Okay, like
Thunderstone, a fire stone, that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I must have forgotten that because it's been so long since I've played.
Now you can only let some of them get over certain levels based on how many badges you have, too, right?
Yeah, it's mostly for traded ones.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
See, I'm catching up, Tucker.
Keep you from getting stuff from the old games, you know, like oh, in my old game I had one that was like level 100 all Mewtwo, so I'm going to use them all.
Yeah, I tried that before too. And I was like, why isn't my Charizard listening to me, you know? And then I finally realized what that badge nonsense was, that it actually had a purpose.
So, Kat, do you think the Heart Gold Soul Silver thing would be as big a deal without the Pokewalker edition?
I don't know, probably not. I mean, it is pretty good in its remake, like one of the best Pokemon games, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going through, like I say, Heart Gold, and it's actually a really good game, but it's just that I wouldn't have known that if that Pokewalker hadn't got me hooked into wanting to sit down with it.
Yeah, it makes you play it all the time, in theory.
In theory.
You're playing Pokemon 24/7.
How big is the... Is the Pokewalker? Is it like having a fanny pack when you're walking around, or is it like a little like keychain-sized device? I haven't even seen any pictures of it.
Well, we posted a pic on the front page. It fits in your palm, like it's a little circular device. So I mean, you fit in your palm with some space to spare.
Okay.
Yeah, I was reading an interview. Like, they designed it to be the same size as like you know in the cartoon where the vault is really small and then it's big.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the same diameter as when it's small.
Nice.
They thought of everything.
But does it shoot out lasers and then summons, pocket monsters with amazing abilities when you throw it? Or does it just break?
No, that's for the Ruby Sapphire remake.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. I'll hold off until that one then.
So let me ask you, because you're obviously a big fan of the series, is it time for a real... larger Pokemon game on like the Wii or a system to come after the Wii?
I don't know, like that seems to be the thing, like it's getting kind of tired where like you start out as this kid and like you're the chosen one and you like catch every legendary Pokemon,
right?
And then, like, it's just this weird thing, you go out and then like you're fighting all your friends and stuff like through Link Cable or online or whatever, and they're also the chosen one and they have every legendary Pokemon ever. So, you know, like, yeah, if it was, like, all integrated somehow, like, I'm sure, like, you'd feel a lot less special, but it might be more fun. I don't know.
Well, what I always didn't sort of like about the handhelds originally and why I didn't spend as much time with them is because I always wanted, like, a console game.
Yeah.
But it's Pocket Monsters. It's not home television monsters, you know?
Well, it's Pokemon. They can do whatever they want. I mean, they got Poke Park Wii coming out out in Japan. I don't know. They do make console versions of Pokemon, just not ones
the main
where you...
series.
Yeah.
There are too many Pokemon nowadays.
You can't catch them all?
I don't think I ever did.
How many are there now?
I think like 493.
Holy shit.
Are you serious? Oh
yeah.
My god.
Went from 151 to 251 to 386, then Damn. Whatever number I said there. It's mind-boggling. That's why I kind of slowed down.
Now. Yeah. Man. They should change the motto to, like, it'd be nice if you caught half of them. You know, like, keep it realistic rather than having the kids set unrealistic goals.
I don't know if they do say you gotta catch them all anymore, do they? That's my thing back from watching the cartoon.
Maybe like, damn, there's a whole hell of a lot of them. I think that's a bit more fitting.
That'd be a really long post rap now.
Yeah. By the time you reach the end of it, there would be more Pokemon.
Yeah, they haven't invented new ones before you finished.
Yeah.
Yeah, they keep making references to all these extinct ones. Like, next game, they should just, like, choose some of the really sucky ones from before and just make them extinct.
Pokemon are going extinct now?
Yeah, there are some that, I don't know, some games like the Kabuto and those guys, like, there were fossils that you had to resurrect or something.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, but yeah, the, even extinct Pokemon actually exist also, so that probably won't work.
Yeah.
Now, are you amazed that they've managed to keep the series going as popular for as long as they have?
Oh, not really. I mean, even if, like, as huge as it was, if they only retained, like, half the people, still like that, that's still, like, a lot of people.
Well, I was
that's
at an
still
event.
Still, like, a quarter of the nation's children.
Well, I was at an event for the game last week when they launched it, and there was still, like, no end of people wanting to check it out. And it just reminded me of when it first came out, and there was this just this giant Pikachu at game events all of a sudden, and we didn't really know what the hell it was. And it seems to me that it's managed to remain way more popular than any other franchise like it. And there was a lot of, like, imitator franchises that came out and died off and came out and died off, and people always tell me something, you know, new comes out, and it's a phenomenon, but... like, what is it intrinsically that makes Pokemon live forever?
I think it might be part of the, of sort of having the continuity between each game. And so they have all these people who invest so much time into it. And they're like, yes, I've caught them all. Or, like, I have all these rare Pokemon. And then a new game comes out, and it's like, you don't have all the rare Pokemon anymore. So, I mean, I think for some people it's the... it's the mania of it all and having to stick with it, you know. It's like, well, I could not get the new one and lose all of my work and, you know, the prestige. I did air quotes with my fingers when I said that. of putting in all that work, or I can get it and then after a few weeks of hard playing, you know, earn my prestige again. So yeah. For the crazies, that might be the reason.
Yeah,
at that point, like, the Pokemon become, like, your pets or something. Or your children or something. I don't know.
Well, you've been a fan of the series, obviously, for a long time. I mean, what keeps you plugged into it?
I don't know. It's just all a very ridiculous world, you know? Like they give all these children, like, little lizards with open flames on them and expect them to walk around forests. Just the very premise amuses me.
And, you know, going... towards that idea of, like, these lizards having flames on them. As cheap as I'm sure a lot of them are in that 493 that there are now, there's also just, when I played it back in the 150, a lot of them were just, like, these really appealing and sometimes cute or adorable or just interesting designs of these creatures that, you know, you kind of like, I want to own that. That'd be nice, especially when I was younger, you know? And, like, when I was going through it, after we started this podcast, just looking at some of the Pokemon now, because I haven't looked at them in a while, like, seeing these images and character designs of these creatures is just, a lot of them have this appealing nature to their look that I, you know, almost makes me want to play the games now. So I think that's a big draw to it.
Well, I was thinking about that because when I started out the game, I had one of the three Pokemon that you're allowed to start out with, and of course it's a little bit special, and then you go out. And the first batch I ran into everywhere were kind of boring, but it didn't make me stop playing. I just wanted to get somewhere where there was something other than a Rattatatat.
Or a Pidgey.
Yeah, or the Centipede, or the the sunflower that spits stuff at me.
That one was after my time.
But Kat, you spent a lot of time. You know, drawing your own interpretations on Pokemon at your site, which I actually enjoy quite a bit. What do you think about the design of them overall?
I don't know. They seem to be getting a lot more complex, like, throughout time. Like if, like, Charmander was made today, like, it would be, like, covered in stripes and have a horn on it. I guarantee that. Also, like, there are tons of legendaries now. That bothers me. Like, there was, like, the first one that had Mewtwo and those birds, and that was about it. And now, like,
yeah,
in this last generation, there's about, like, a dozen of them that you can only, like, get through special events and stuff.
Now, I've actually been told that Mew is, when that came out, that that was a really big deal. And that that really helped the series.
Well, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
like,
they just...
Like, I was, like, going, like, crazy. Like, Mew is the reason I saw the first movie. I mean, I was, I was that into it back in the day. But, you know, because you had, like, this list of, like, 150 Pokemon, and you're totally addicted to them, and you're like, okay, I can catch all of these. You know, there's these two games, and you can go through and get them all. And, and then, like, there's these... you know, you start to hear word of the 151st Pokemon, and back in the day, that was totally, like, mind-blowing.
So, and Peekaboo.
Yeah. And, you know, even in the first episode of the series, you would saw what became the first additional legendary bird, which is, like, what, Ho-Oh or something?
Yeah.
And so you're like, well, crap, you know, that's not one of the 150... Nor is it Mew, so it's like, what the hell is this then? You know, like, there's even more. So your mind is kind of, like, blown, like, how, like, what else is out there? And it's an unknown. Whereas now it's like, well, it's not an unknown. It's just a, will
Make
be revealed when they add. Yeah, it'll be, like, one of the next 100 they add. So, you know, like, the sort of wonder that you have as far as questioning what else is out there.
Right.
That's gone, I think, now from the Pokemon series. And I think that's part of the reason why I lost a lot of interest in it. Because it's like, well, you know, there'll just be more. And
I was thinking, like, maybe that's why, like, all those other, like, non-playable character trainers that you run into. Like,
yeah.
It seems like you're the only one who bothers to, like, diversify a team and stuff and, you know, build it up. But, like, maybe, like, all these other guys have just gotten really cynical, too. Like, they've seen all these ones, like, oh, I don't care about all these Pokemon. I just want to play with these three Geodudes.
You know, you might be onto something, because I ended up in a tower where every monk had just, like, six Bellsprouts. So you might be onto something there. But that's interesting that you, because that new Pokemon, like I say, that they had in Japan and, you know, played it up as a huge thing, was a very complicated design. And it seems really far away from the originals, like you say. One of my favorites in the original was, like, Psyduck, because he was just the plainest looking thing ever, and he wandered around with a headache, right? So, like...
Yeah. He was hilarious in the cartoon series. Like, in the cartoon series, like, all right, just to go off on my tangent of Naruto series, he was the same thing. He was like this sort of annoying Pokemon that one of the main character trainers had, and he always had a headache, and like he would always summon himself from a Pokeball whenever like the trainer didn't want him, and she was like, what are you doing here, I hate you, and he would just, you know, do his Psyduck call and like screw something up. Yeah,
it's like Beavis.
I am
Doc Julio. Yeah, I mean, it stands out forever because he would only attack when, you know, you hit him hard enough to make his headache worse.
Yeah.
So I kind of relate it to that. But, yeah, they were, I don't know, there was a lot of simple designs, and maybe that made, like, the odd one, like a horse with a flaming mane, stand out a little bit more.
Yeah.
But now everything just seems very loud and... I don't know, can the series keep going like it is and just keep releasing DS games or whatever new handheld comes out maybe at E3 or next Christmas?
I'm sure it'll happen. It's like, even if it outstays its welcome,
as long as it, you know, doesn't outstay people buying it. I think it has a lot of years left. Yeah. And I think it still has a lot of years left, because, I mean, even if I kind of outgrew it about a decade ago. Like, I mean, there are also people who stick with it, and then new people like you, Jamie, who are getting into it now. And then there's all, you know, there's always like these kids out there who go like, what are these like crazy looking things, you know? And it's made to appeal to them. So I think Pokemon are going to be around as long as any other of Nintendo's big characters, like, you know, Mario or Link.
Welcome to 2023. Big businesses now merge with alien nations. An ancient war is being fought under the sea. The president is about to be cloned. And it's your job to try and save the world. So you've got an important decision to make. What are you going to wear to work? From the team who brought you GoldenEye for N64, meet Special Agent Joanna Dark in Perfect Dark, where you'll find out that the only person man enough to handle a job like this is a woman. Perfect Dark, rated M for mature.
And you guys won't know this, but I'm going to play the Perfect Dark commercial from the N64 game before we get into all this.
Nice.
You know, set the mood.
Works for me.
Yeah, because then I can say, obviously, we're talking about Perfect Dark on XBLA, which is the only thing on XBLA that matters this week, and maybe next week and the week after that. And joining me to talk about that is 4CR's Gregory Gay.
Hi, guys.
And shared asset, Michael Tucker, who is slipping in and out of a medicated coma.
Yes, that's what's happening right now. So, Perfect Dark on Xbox. Have you tried it yet, Jamie?
Yeah, I downloaded it this week. I know Greg won't have got a chance to play with it, but the minute it got announced it was coming out, I knew I was going to want to have this session because we're both huge Perfect Dark fans.
The second I get back to my apartment, that Xbox is going on and I'm downloading that game.
You know, it's not that big either. It's 260 megs or something.
Well, it's like an N64 game, so how big can it be?
Well, they bumped it up, right?
Yeah, they did up-res it, but I mean, there's still... I didn't expect it to be that huge.
But it's nice because they didn't go overboard with the way they bumped it up. So it just looks very smoothed out, and all the jagged lines and jumpy frame rate issues are gone. Or they seem to be.
Cassandra still looks like a man?
The facial textures are a little strange, and guards still want to run right into my line of fire. But I'm loving it so far. I haven't got to try any co-op yet. That's
but
what's sick.
Do you know if you, when you get hit by those certain grenades, or if you get punched in multiplayer, does the screen still get like blurry to fucking hell?
See, I haven't got to try any multiplayer yet, so.
Oh man.
I'm waiting for Greg to get his ass back to this country.
Tucker, the answer is yes. Actually, I saw a video of it.
Oh really?
Yeah. So if you get punched, the screen still gets blurry.
Well, I guess, I mean, there's the nostalgia factor. I guess that's better than the blindness factor.
Now, what I don't know is whether the N-bombs are still N-bombs. Maybe they're called, like, M-bombs now. I don't know. You gotta remove every Nintendo reference there.
Well, I was gonna spend tonight trying to figure out if the cheese did anything useful was my top priority.
That was gonna be my next question.
Yeah, I hope cheese is still there.
I'm hoping so too. I think somebody told me it was, but I haven't found out yet. But
how do the controls feel, Jamie?
I haven't tried the other two control settings that they've added. But the one that's meant for the Perfect Dark faithful feels really good on those Microsoft thumbsticks.
Okay.
It's really smooth, and you just got a better button layout. So switching between weapons, it's right there. By your fingertips. I didn't feel like I was fuddling around with it.
Nice.
What are the other two settings, Greg? One emulates Halo and the other one's Call of Duty?
That's right.
Yeah, I haven't tried those out yet.
I gotta be honest, I'll probably just stick with the old style controls. I mean, it'll feel right. I think you'd feel wrong playing it like Halo.
It felt right the minute I picked it up today, and... yeah, I don't think I'm going to get incredibly experimental with it. because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I can see why they would add that. I think it's good that they did.
And, I mean, as much crap as I sometimes give the N64 controller, this is a game that I've sunk enough time into on the N64 where, honestly, I kind of just want to take that and hook it up to the Xbox.
You are going to be the only one that says that.
Yeah, I mean, I like how you said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Whereas, you know, like, honestly, I think the entire control scheme of the 64 first-person shooters, you know, as good as it was for back then, like, today, comparatively, it's, I mean, it totally feels broken. I mean, I, you know, I love Perfect Dark, but I would probably play with the Halo control scheme, you know. But that's just me. You know, I'm probably a bastard for that, whatever.
Well,
that's okay.
You're not actually holding the N64 controller, right? You're holding the 360 controller.
Yeah.
And I noticed the difference immediately because, I mean, in multiplayer on the 64, I always had trouble with that controller.
Okay.
It was just the kind of controller you were either really good with it or you weren't. And I never, ever got the hang of that controller. I just can't wrap my head around it.
So, let me just ask real quick for the classic control scheme on the Xbox controller, though, it's looking around, and then do you have to, like, press a button to go into aim mode?
Yeah, if you want to get your targeted aim, you press the left trigger.
Okay.
And then the right triggers your fire.
All right, yeah, that's something I just never...
Yeah.
But,
so it was actually you could get it going pretty quick, and the guards were still moving around pretty quick. And that game still has what I would consider the deadliest AI, if you want to set it that way.
Yes.
Sadistic. Dude,
I know you haven't played the multiplayer yet, but have you looked at the bot options? Like, are they the same options as in the original?
I haven't gone through it all yet, because, to be honest, I played through it for a couple hours on single player, and then I was like, okay, I got to talk to you guys about this, because it's the perfect excuse to just bring up Perfect Dark again.
Right on.
Because we've been waiting for this game for so long. And,
yeah, well, I mean, I think people were waiting for GoldenEye, and then they're like, we'll never get GoldenEye, so let's do Perfect Dark.
But Perfect Dark, why would you want GoldenEye again? Perfect Dark was better in every way.
I think that depends on who you ask, because when people go to best first-person shooter of all time, they always say GoldenEye. I liked Perfect Dark more. Perfect Dark, I think, was kind of a cooler experience, but when you think back to the best N64 iconic first-person shooter, I mean, it's that has to be GoldenEye, and I think that I bet Microsoft just really wanted GoldenEye. When they realized they wouldn't get it, they went for Perfect Dark.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of go with GoldenEye being the perfect N64 shooter. I mean, my investment in Perfect Dark is more about its future potential.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I wanted to talk about, because, I mean, it's taken a long time to get this over onto XBLA, and it's been quite a while since Perfect Dark Zero. So, you know, I think it's time to, again, talk about what the hell Microsoft plans on doing, if anything, with the series.
That's a good question. I don't really know. Like, I don't have any insight into this. I have no idea what Microsoft really intends. Around Perfect Dark Zero, there was that big push of it as being, you know, a big franchise. Like, they're the novels released and the comic books and all of that, like, around Perfect Dark Zero. And those were actually, I gotta say, those are really good novels. If you haven't considered looking at them because they're video game tie-ins.
Well, I mean, I have because I'm a nerd like you, but see, this is where Perfect Dark becomes more important to me than GoldenEye because, I mean, it's just got so much potential. It's the ultimate could-be series.
And Tucker might be interested in this, that the novels were written by Greg Rucka, who did Queen of Country.
I haven't heard of that, actually.
Oh, okay, I know Luckett's really into Queen and Country, so for some reason I assumed you might be too. I have no idea why.
No. I'll look into it, though. I mean, if he's into it and you're into it, then it's definitely something I'm sure I'll want to look at.
That's a pretty great comic series, but I guess that's unrelated to the current talk.
Well, tangentially it is. But I have a question. Was the port Is Rare still around? Was it done by Rare, or who did this?
No, it was done by another team.
Okay.
Yeah, it was ported by their team. Yeah, Rare's still around.
What have they done?
Rare consulted.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Anyway, going back sort of to Rare, now that Perfect Dark has been re-released, what do you think our chances are of seeing Time Splitters 2 re-released? Now that's the game I really want to see.
Well, I see now you're talking about a company that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
For reals, I mean, I don't even know who claims ownership over that series when something like that happens.
That's something I want to look into, because that is the game I want. You know, I love Perfect Dark, but, you know,
you want Perfect Dark 3 or 01 or whatever the hell they want to call it. That's what we need.
Well, that's what I would think, you know, going by a certain rule of logic. But then again, you think, well, Perfect Dark was made by Rare, and then Rare ceased to be Rare when all the good people left and went to start Free Radical. And then Free Radical imploded and, you know, disappeared. And so now I don't really care about what is going to be done with Perfect Dark, because for me, like, it can't exist anymore. It's just the memory of, like, that classic game. So,
see, now I think you're skipping over Haze when you're going through this argument.
Oh, yeah. No, that is good. Well, everyone makes bad decisions. Right? So they never got a chance after that. You know, without having played it, you know, like, I'll say Haze was a huge mistake on their part, just from everything I heard and from even the demo that I played. But I mean, they get like, I would give the Free Radical guys, not that I can or that they have one, but I would give them another shot, you know, until I was like, okay, they lost it. Because I mean, I heard really bad stuff about, who made Too Human again?
Silicon Knights?
Yeah. So I mean, like, they made some great games, and they had that stinker, and, you know, I would just not write. Anyway.
Do you have no hope that after Perfect Dark Zero that Rare can make a good first-person shooter?
I have no faith in Rare from what I had heard of Cameo. Yeah, from Perfect Dark Zero. Even from my understanding, they kind of, like, I loved Conker's Bad Fur Day, and I loved the original multiplayer when they ported that. Like, I didn't even know what I was playing when I played the multiplayer of that. So it's, you know, it's like, to me, it's just a name of a company that had people in it that I liked before. So, I don't know, if we see a Perfect Dark sequel, like, what I'm expecting is probably a downloadable title. Not like, you know, like how this re-release of Perfect Dark was downloadable. You know, maybe some 2D, weird, experimental, maybe even bastardization of the series, but something.
Oh, so the Game Boy Color game.
Oh yeah, I played that too. I think I don't even remember if I hated it or liked it. I remember playing the Game Boy Color game too.
It was pretty awful.
Oh yeah.
I'm telling you right now, Tucker, what Perfect Dark needs to reboot it, and not necessarily done by Rare, obviously, is some really ambitious Half-Life 2-esque.
That would be fucking awesome, doubt it's going to happen.
Yeah,
well, I didn't say it was going to happen. That's what it needs, because the problem is this amazing franchise that appeals to, you know, has amazing mainstream potential and also has a very niche following, and it's just sitting there rotting. Like, there should be a meter running to tally how much money Microsoft is losing by doing nothing with it.
Well, I bet what's going to happen with Perfect Dark is the same thing that they're apparently doing to Tomb Raider. You know, which is just downsize it to a downloadable only.
Well, that's a side experiment. I mean, they've come out now because people were like, what the hell are you doing? And said, well, this is a sidestep and there's still going to be traditional Tomb Raider.
Okay. Well, I still see, like, maybe for, like, the main Perfect Dark potential, I think, would lie is downloadable. Maybe even like a Shadow Complex sort of game. I mean, it's a name people know, but it's Perfect Dark. I'm sure that they'll try to do something new with it and hardly make it Perfect Dark still, but keep the name because they know it'll make some money.
I could actually get into that Shadow Complex idea.
Be interesting.
Yeah.
think that could be cool.
It could be fun. It wouldn't seem like what I would expect from Perfect Dark, but yeah, it definitely could be fun.
All right, so Jamie, sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah,
there.
No, that's fine. I wanted to know what you think specifically, because I mean, a lot of the times we'll be begging companies to stop milking a franchise, and you love Perfect Dark as much as I do, obviously, and this is one of those times where we're begging a company to go back and almost do whatever the hell they want just to keep a franchise alive. Do I sound insane?
No. What I want Microsoft to do is, I mean, I don't want to completely write Rare off altogether because I have a secret Viva Pinata fetish.
Not secret anymore.
Well, yeah, let's go around the circle here on it, okay? Because the thing that made Rare great was that they wouldn't milk a franchise and they wouldn't rest on their laurels. So after they did GoldenEye, you know, they didn't go do Tomorrow Never Dies. They didn't do GoldenEye 2. You know, they left that to EA to spend $50 million on six freaking experimental stupid releases on. They went and made Perfect Dark, and they put everything plus the kitchen sink in there. And we love them for it, but it also, you know, Rare, even though a lot of people are gone, still maintains that always going in new directions policy. And it's the one time that I fucking hate it.
Well, Jamie, what I want Microsoft to do is I want Microsoft to buy the Perfect Dark franchise from Rare. I want Microsoft to take over that franchise, and I want them to put another developer on it. And that way Rare gets to keep their new directions thing. And honestly, even though I said I don't want to give up on Rare, I'm questionable about their ability to make a new great first-person shooter.
Well, I think they're pretty focused on Natal from everything we've been hearing. So I mean, the odds of them...
I like your suggestion, though, Greg. I think that actually, if I feel that there's a good chance of my interest returning to Perfect Dark as it was when it first came out, it would be, I think, if Microsoft just went in and took over this title and gave it to someone else to do something new with.
So I guess my question there is, who should develop that? I don't think Bungie should. I think their style's too different.
I think the overarching approach that they've done, though, with Halo Reach right now, going back to an origin kind of for the series and doing the anime and stuff like that, I think that all might apply very well to the series.
I guess that's true.
I think Perfect Dark has good potential for that, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not picturing... I mean, I think Bungie could handle it just fine. But, like, Marathon and Halo, their play styles, I guess, are kind of different from what I have in my mind as the Perfect Dark experience.
Well, I'm telling you, you need Valve to make Perfect Dark 3.
Let them focus on Half-Life. Yeah, they won't do it. Let them focus on Half-Life. They don't need any more distractions. But, no, you know who should do it? They should just give that to Team Ninja, too. Let them take over it. just, you know, when everything needs a new direction, take it to Team Ninja.
Perfect Dark, Other P. You heard it.
Other P.
Let's get scratching.
Last week, I was talking to someone, having a little bit of industry chatter, And they know that I'm a huge fan of Metroid and that I write about it endlessly, even if I don't really have anything that constructive to say anymore. And just fap about Metroid.
Right.
So they're asking me why. Like, they want to know more about the series. So I'm talking about all these ideals that and ideas that I've written about. And they said, okay, but, you know, let's say I have a kid at home and you want me to understand why they might like playing Metroid. And it was sort of like, you know, could you sum up this game for that situation? And I was really, really stumped to actually just come up with a simplistic explanation of why this game was good and fun and why someone might enjoy it. When I'm not specifically talking to one of you guys or another gamer, right?
Who like just intrinsically understands, like, without words and being necessary.
Yeah, which makes me worry incredibly that, you know, we're all just talking to each other and eventually we'll all die off and all.
No, I don't. I think the things we talk about are still valid. I think that sense of isolation, that intrinsic wonder and exploration in a Metroid title, I think those are things we can, of course, write about in this high level. But at the same time, like, even a kid, like, even when I was young playing Super Metroid, you know, I might not have necessarily understood that feeling of isolation or being in this alien world. But they're these like fundamental, like, instinctual things. I think, you know, still appeal to even kids.
But what I want to get at is, you know, do you think
how to explain that?
No. Because when I was going through this conversation and I felt stumped like that, I was wondering if, you know, maybe Nintendo's ahead of the curve and this is Nintendo or this is Metroid for a new generation.
No, that's a reasonable.
That we'll still have things we'll be attached to, of course, but maybe that's why I'm having a hard time. Like, Tucker, the last time we talked about Metroid was talking about how the color scheme kind of seemed weird. And it sort of had this comic booky anime vibe to it and the designs. And
I'll explain, like, I'll get to how I would sum up Metroid is awesome. Like, you know, and I agree that the isolation and the wonder exploration and just sort of like xenophobia mixed with like the wonder of being in alien places is cool. But that's always been like an aspect of Metroid, never like really to me the core of what's amazing about it. And for me, the core of Metroid's awesomeness is that Samus is badass. That's why when I look at Other M, it's like, you know, everything looks cheesy and they lost the sort of alien, fearing unknown that has kind of been in the series up till now. But to me, it still looks awesome because Samus looks fucking badass, you know?
Okay.
And it's, you know, and like, you know.
So was that what I was missing? My hesitancy to just go, oh, you know what? It's because Samus is badass. Because might be it.
To me, like, that's sort of like my honest admission, you know, like, other people may be like, well, you're a fucking idiot, you probably love Halo, go play your stupid whatever games, but for me, like, you got this really cool protagonist that you are, you know, she's not like some stereotypical army badass shooter guy, she's, you know, she's like kind of the typical action badass armor sci-fi hero, but with a lot of a few little tweaks, which are what make her cool and make me want to play the games as her. And, like, you know, the alien stuff has always been, like, the aloneness, isolation has been, you know, a cool aspect of it that really we associated with her. But I think the experiment of putting her in sort of a more action-oriented game isn't completely dissolving of everything that the series has been up till now.
Well, I've got to actually step in here before JB gets in. I think part of why I love Samus so much is that the games have done a pretty good job of putting you in there as Samus. Like, you are Samus in these games.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily because, you know, the story paints Samus as this awesome person. It's because it paints Samus as an awesome person who at the same time is you.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I guess I kind of see that. Like, And I agree. It was really cool to be her in a lot of these games. But for me, the balance was never quite hit as well as the Half-Life series does, of really giving you control of her, but really painting her as herself. Which is kind of funny because this is what Other M is doing. It's really bringing out who Samus is. Whereas even in the Prime series, you went and you scanned stuff and you learned about the world. But all Samus ever was in the cutscenes. She was just there. You saw people talking to her, but it was them who were talking. She only, you got the sense of she was there, but she had very little emotion or expression. It was just sort of being there. And while that's cool up to a point, it never became more than that. Not that it needed to be for what those games were going to be, but it wasn't at the same time.
Yeah, but see, that's why I think that's why I love the Prime games so much, because again, that's the, Samus isn't a huge part of Samus is there, and it's sort of up to you to define that emotional experience.
I get what you're saying.
You are Samus. You are experiencing these harsh environments. You are being thrown into the story.
Now, does that make it hard to sum a game like that up in a few sentences for the back of a box?
It does.
Yeah. And that's a good point. I think that's part of the reason why they're updating it. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I think maybe Other M, maybe the big story focus, defining who Samus is. I think there's a large audience who loves that.
Right.
And I think there's a large audience for whom that's the right thing. And what appealed to me, especially about the Prime games, that putting you in Samus's shoe and you exploring those alien worlds, maybe that's something that's a limited appeal. Mm-hmm. That's something I love. I fully acknowledge
that. It's something that we've done a lot of interviews where we talk to designers, obviously, or I've done a few where I've gotten to talk to some cool designers, and to talk about how you sell a game, and it always inevitably comes back to games are sold on graphics and narrative, because that's what you can immediately see.
Yeah.
And what's amazing about the Prime Trilogy is that you really had to sit down and hold it in your hands and play it and look at it and experience it. And once you did, 99% you're sold. But to get someone to sit down and do that is, a huge hassle.
Right. Yeah, but Metroid Prime 3, especially, sold millions of copies.
Sure, but now millions of copies isn't enough, right? Because people want 20 and 30 millions of copies.
And plus, Prime had the the cool aspect of being the first promisingly good game that used the relatively new Wii Remote as the gun that you could hold, and it was the third game in a trilogy, so there was all that hype, and I mean that had a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
going
for it.
Oh, I asked about that for you too, Greg.
Okay.
I asked about the controller switch and Other M, and Pikachu said, "Don't sweat it; it's very smooth."
Okay.
So, I mean, you heard.
Oh, I trust Pikachu's game opinions.
Yeah, he was doing pretty good. I mean, he was under a lot of stress because he had kids poking him left and right, but he was doing good.
I can't imagine him holding the Wii Remote in his tiny hands. Anyway,
I guess they're more flippers.
Well, he's got digits on him.
Yeah,
I think talking about sales wise, I think Other M will be this. I think Other M will be a massive success and will probably dwarf the Prime games.
Japanese sales.
Especially Japanese sales, but I think American too. I think Other M. Now, a lot of it doesn't necessarily appeal to me still. But I think it's something that appeals to a broader audience.
Yeah. We always just get back talking about Metroid.
Especially in Japan. I think that the whole anime focus, it utterly turns me off. But Japanese otaku would be all over that.
See, I think I'm not really completely confident in the performance of Other M, because the Prime series, at least for American sales, had that first-person aspect going for it. And like you were saying, I think in Japan, it won't have a worry. But I don't know if it's the sort of game with its colors and its not full-on first-person experience, if it will be able to be sold to the audience as well.
Well, I think,
they'll be able to sell it on Team Ninja.
I think you got to go back to Fusion. I actually went back and I read one of Greg's last pieces about Metroid. Doctor Fusion. You remember that, don't you, Greg?
Yeah.
And, you know, I went back and now I don't know how it didn't stand out more, but I mean, the entire time that Retro was working on that series, there were these Metroid titles pushing the Japanese agenda on handhelds. That was what was going to come after Retro was done with that series.
That's a good point.
Fusion is the most crazy colored, upside down, weirdo freaking Metroid game. It really is. I mean,
yeah.
I like
it. Totally right.
I played through it many times now, but I mean, it's just such a weird, like the suit that you end up with in that is just so. Weird.
And then the revision of the first Metroid, like that was very much in the same Japanese anime style.
Yeah,
Zero Mission would be awesome.
Go ahead.
Well, Infusion also latched on to the Super Metroid ending.
That's true.
And that's Fusion. At the end, you face off and sort of have this Super Metroid moment where. You know, the evil Samus saves you at the end.
That's a good point.
I don't know. There's just a lot of similarities now that I've gone back to.
I think then this might bring up, like, maybe the idea that if the sort of titles we've been seeing on Metroid on the handhelds are going to the console, maybe we'll see the retro sort of style of Metroids going onto handhelds. So we'll see a really atmospheric.
So they're just going to swap it out.
Prime Hunters is awful.
Well, no, I mean like Prime Hunters, but done well, maybe, you know, not Prime Hunters done as Prime Hunters.
And not Prime Hunters then.
Prime Hunters works well for what it is. I mean, the fact that it works at all at the time that it came out.
But that's like saying, like, it works well for what it is, so, like, it's not a good game, but it's okay because it's not a good game.
Yeah, we say that shit all the time. I'll be like, you know, 10 out of 10, don't go buy it.
Yeah.
Like, totally.
Yeah, I'm just clarifying. Yeah.
You know.
I mean, yeah. It's,
I think if Fusion and, like, I think if the handheld games that came out at that time, like, if they're the future of the series, I'm still kind of comfortable with that. I think Zero Mission and Fusion both... They still did some of the, you know, they still did the exploration. They still did the weird alien world stuff really well. Fusion had a lot more of the story, and some of that was, it was okay in Fusion. I think it looks worse in Other M, but like if Other M plays a lot like the handheld games, I'd be comfortable with that.
I think we started off talking about Perfect Dark, and then it'll talk about Metroid again.
And, I think we're going to talk about Metroid every week. How about? You know, next week's
just
Four
the Metroid
Color Rebellion podcast.
Yeah. But I'm telling you that Perfect Dark is Microsoft needs to get on it and make it their Metroid. And that's why we ended up doing this. It's all subconscious, but that's why you did it.
You know what? 10 years from now, I want us to have a podcast where we're talking about the how the next Perfect Dark game is going to ruin the feeling of the series.
You know what I want is a lightning round. Where I just fire questions at you guys, and you answer for points, and readers win things, and nothing is what it is.
You don't give me time to think, though. Like, you'll have to censor half of what I say if it involves Metroid or Dark.
I just think it'd be a really nice way to cut through the news, but I'm not prepared to go there right now. But I think it's something to look into.
Well, I mean, this has been the first Game Trigger podcast, so we have plenty of time to refine it and make sure that maybe we can get the lightning round idea in there later.
Yeah, that's true.
Wait, this is the Game Sugar podcast? Oh shit.
Tucker, what the hell? So, a little addendum to this week's podcast, although this is kind of like so this is like the end of the podcast, and then now we're just going on and on and on. So, we survived our first one.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
But, during our Perfect Dark talk with Greg, I brought up Valve, and I thought, you know what? I got Tucker here. We should talk about Valve. Because I walked away, and I started thinking about how cool a Valve Perfect Dark game would be. Not that it will ever exist.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we were also talking about the amazing multiplayer of Perfect Dark. and how the sort of a counter-op mode isn't something that we've really ever seen come to full fruition since, but the closest thing there is to it, I think, is probably the versus mode in Left 4 Dead.
Right. So,
like you were saying, it'd be cool if Valve made Perfect Dark because of like the style of the game or something. Isn't that what you were saying?
Well, I went away and I was thinking about it, and I mean, the first thing I thought of when I originally said that was the way in-game narrative is developed. Because when I said that, Perfect Dark could be Microsoft's Metroid, a lot of what I think about is the way that if they could just put you in Joanna's skin and let you experience the world of Perfect Dark, that's what the legs of the game really should be going forward.
Right.
So, obviously, we ended up talking about Metroid, but, you know, we also talk about Valve a lot when we get a chance, and I neglected Gordon Freeman because there's a character where I can't separate him from myself because we were in his skin entirely.
Which was, like, the best way to view that world, too.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that's sort of a difference between the original Perfect Dark, I think, and the Half-Life games. Is because, like, while it would be great to actually, like, sort of be in Joanna's skin and experience the world, I think largely because of hardware limitations and stuff, at the time, Perfect Dark was much more of a level-based sort of first-person shooter. And, like, while there were very sort of open and interesting levels, considering what was capable at the time that it was made, it's very much more level-based than it is world-based, so we didn't get to see as much of that world as we got to see of, like, stuff in Half-Life.
Right, but, I think the levels of Perfect Dark are designed for the shooting, not the
world.
And then everything's layered on top of the design of the shooting.
Yeah, but to experience, if someone does make a future Perfect Dark, to see it set up sort of like the Half-Life narrative and experiences, that would be very, very interesting, because Perfect Dark is like, it's like the Blade Runner / Neuromancer of the video game world.
Right.
So, of course, that's a world that people want to see more of.
Yeah, and I mean, it's got that rare sort of tinge of weird to it with Elvis and everything. But yeah. I don't think that's so out of the realm of Valve. I mean, I think they're...
No, Valve is a very, you know, interesting humor-based sort of developer. I mean, as serious as the Half-Life series is, and it has like a good number of jokes that are fitting within the series. Like Left 4 Dead is like a total, like, it's a weird serious parody, you know,
right,
of zombie movies, and then Team Fortress 2 is just like all out adult cartoon humor.
Yeah, well, I think Half-Life 2 is very serious and dark and straightforward, but, I mean, when was the last time you played the original Half-Life?
I think about a year ago.
Okay, so you'll really... It really goes in a weird direction at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's incredibly straightforward, and, you know, if you played them in reverse, you'd be like, okay, this is kind of like a precursor to Half-Life 2. Makes sense. And then you end up in the alien dimension, and it's like all bets are off, and it just becomes this weird roller coaster.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you know, it almost kind of breaks the suspension of disbelief, because whereas Half-Life 2, and I did play it in reverse, you know, I played all the Half-Life 2 games, and then I downloaded Half-Life 1.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and okay. It was very boring in comparison, like very boring, and not really a lot of fun. I mean, I don't have the nostalgia factor of playing it first like everyone else did.
Right.
But especially when you get to the third area, it's like, you know, this is like way like early 2000s, 90s-ish sort of weirdness, you know, that they really wouldn't do these days. And it was very different.
I played that... I got a chance to play that on the Dreamcast, even though that game never came out on the Dreamcast.
yeah.
There is a copy for the Dreamcast.
Right.
But you should go buy your copy. You know, I'm not getting anything here. But because it has load times, like every 2 minutes you walk like 10 feet and it has to load.
Yeah.
And I got like 15 minutes into it and died and had to go through it all. So it's just like the hell to this. That was the last time I tried to play Half-Life, but I have finished the game.
Nice.
because that train ride at the beginning is great, but if you have
to
play it because you didn't save, oh man, does that suck.
Yeah, and but like that's the interesting thing. That opening train ride, having played all the following episodes of Half-Life 2 and Half-Life 2 after or before playing the original Half-Life,
right.
The opening train ride was still interesting, you know?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you...
And like, as sort of unimpressive as the rest of the game was, having played it way after it was made, the way that they really introduced that game, it was very... it drew me in, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to top City 17 going backwards like that, but...
So how do you think, specifically, what sort of stuff would you like to see in, a Valve-esque Perfect Dark? Like, what would you want it to be similar to?
Well, I mean, when you think of the tactileness of the weapons and, you think
do
of
you
the...
mean, like, sound effects and stuff? Or, like, how do you mean tactile?
You know, it's really hard for me to explain, but Half-Life 2 I always think of as a perfect shooter because it just felt perfect. When you fired a weapon, it really felt like you were firing a weapon.
Yeah.
Now, I've played Half-Life 2 a lot on the Xbox, and I don't know if that has something to do with it because of those triggers on the controller. But when you fire off that automatic machine gun, I mean, it just feels like you're firing off an automatic machine gun, you know?
Yeah, that's, my experience with the Half-Life 2 series has been on the Xbox as well. And, I think the triggers are a very good accompaniment, as well as, the rumble and the sound is a large part, and the recoil and everything.
Right.
And I think that is obviously due in large part to something we were talking about earlier, which is sort of Valve's clinical approach to game design, it seems, you know?
Scientific, even.
Yeah, it's like there's all this talk about games being art and the expression that's involved in them, but my favorite developer in the world, Valve Games, they are sort of the opposite of what all these people are trying to say games are. They're like a group started by a company started by a former Microsoft programmer,
right?
And all these sort of people who are known for their genius concepts more so than their amazing art. And there is amazing art involved, team, don't get me wrong.
For sure.
But it's a very intelligence-based approach to game design they seem to have. And anyone would know that if they played their games with the commentary, especially.
Well, I think it's almost like they figured out the science of fun.
Yeah.
Really, because, I've talked to you about it before, you're playing through Half-Life 2, and every bullet just seems to be portioned out exactly as you would need it.
Yeah. Whenever you start to run low, it's always in the right spot, you know?
Yeah, the distances between buildings, the way that, block points are set up with soldiers, the way soldiers are positioned in levels, the way they'll just suddenly unleash, a giant crab beast on you, but give you...
Yeah, where they place the scripted events in the game. Even the positions of stuff. So, the likelihood of you seeing these little flourishes they add in the game, it's always in the right spot, you know? And, yeah. I mean, in the commentary, they explain, the process it took them to get that right, and that's one of the great things about Valve games.
Well, I think if you go back to Perfect Dark when it was first being made, we'll say now it was an incredibly ambitious title that squeezed a lot in, but there was even more that they wanted to get in there that they couldn't.
Yeah, like the cheese.
Yeah, well, the cheese, of course, but also...
spaces?
Yeah, but what I'm thinking about more is, they wanted to do more with, the play of light and dark.
Oh, yeah?
That's why the series was called Perfect Dark.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they really wanted to push the technology of what was possible and, just push the genre further at the same time that they were developing this world. And when I think of all those things together, I just think of Valve.
Yeah, that's a good point. The Rare that made Perfect Dark, they sort of seem like a weird precursing company to what we see now in Valve. Where, it's you know, there's a lot of art and expression and stuff like that in games, but they really just wanted to create not the design by committee sort of games that sell really well, but they wanted to push like everything as intelligently and immersively as possible.
Yeah, I almost think that obviously a lot of people left Rare, but they're really hung up on the branding now. It seems to be when they design things.
Yeah.
And the idea, like, I've written about it before, but I mean, Joanna Dark and Perfect Dark Zero is total committee thinking because there's like 50 different variations on what she might look like in that game.
And she ended up looking like out of the game, you know?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, Don's approach is to let the world define the character.
Yeah,
defined the character by playing in that world, but, well, you know what I mean.
Yeah, like making them identifiable and, you know, unique and still, you know, the brand is sort of something that they have in mind, but you can tell, like, that's not all they were thinking about. And I remembered I was reading Half-Life 2 Raising the Bar a few weeks ago.
Right.
And they're talking about the design of the characters and as they get to Alex, you know, they had this sort of, like, this cool-looking girl with, like, a punk haircut and, you know, a satchel. And, you know, not too dissimilar from what Joanna Dark became in Perfect Dark Zero.
Right.
But they're, you know, like, right before they were saying, right before they showed the, like, the first demo preview or whatever, they're like, well, what makes her different from everyone else?
Right.
You know, and I think that's, you know, the sort of thing that Valve does, is like they have that left, that spark of intelligence that lets them ask these questions, whereas, you know, in a lot of other games it's like, well, what makes these characters different? You could say, well, not much really, but people have seen this before and they like it, so it seems like a lot of games will go with that design, whereas Valve, like, they like to be unique.
Yeah, well, I think everyone gets into this industry with a story to tell.
Yeah.
But doesn't always, like, everyone thinks their story is unique and it's going to push the bar, but I mean, that can't be your only angle.
Right.
I think you see that in Perfect Dark Zero, where, well, we're going to tell the backstory of Joanna Dark. So that just writes itself, right? And goes on autopilot, you know, and Valve doesn't rest on just one angle. They, like, you know, when you get a game like Portal, they push every single point.
Right.
So, I mean, what you're doing, how you're doing it, who you are, why you are, I mean, nothing is left unturned.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's unfortunate that there aren't more companies that want to push their products that hard, but I guess then we wouldn't appreciate the ones that do as much as we do.
Well, I mean, the contrast is a good thing, you know. I would like to see better quality all around for sure, though. But I think like the one of the, like, the great thing about Valve as well is that you know, game requires a balance of you know, vision but craftsmanship as well. Like, whether or not you argue if games are arts or if they are just products, you know, they require craftsmanship.
Right.
It's not just, you know, great vision or this amazing epic thing to tell. And I think that's where Valve really gets it right, because if you listen to the commentary, it's all about how they set everything up and how it plays and how it feels, and then they mold everything around that armature. And so it's like they have a well-built game, and around that game they can build, like, a great design, you know. And if you look at sort of all other aspects of art, that's really, like, how great art is, you know, from having a mastery of painting, or, you know, a good structure for architecture, and then everything else is to once it's acceptable and just a damn good base, then you can get a damn good design around that.
Sure, and I think that's why they're in a league of their own. I mean, I would place as far as craftsmanship, you know, the way we think about a lot of Nintendo titles, where you don't even question if a lot of that stuff's going to be good or not, because you just know that their finest craftsmen are going to hammer it out and make it work, right?
Yeah. They get experimental sometimes, but yeah, like, a lot of the main Nintendo games are just no doubt great.
Yeah, and Valve does that, but with more of a North American sensibility that pulls in a lot of cultural stew that you and me are obviously part of. So I think we relate to that. And I mean, that's because I know a lot of people are going to listen to this podcast and go, wow, this dude's really like nuts about Perfect Dark. But it's not just one part of it. It's because there are so many repetitive stories. And it's not that Perfect Dark is a unique story. It's the way it brings together all those elements of culture that, you know, and the way it could bring together, you know, music and our thoughts about the future and technology and character development and morality. And it's really, you know, if you could get all those stars to align, it would be the horse to bet on. And that's why I go on endlessly about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I mean, if you look at like Blade Runner or Neuromancer, which are fictions in other mediums that are very similar in the setting and period of, and everything as Perfect Dark, they were really pioneers for what they are. You know, Neuromancer invented, you know, was the first novel to really explore what cyberspace was. And, you know, it was pretty much groundbreaking for, it created cyberpunk pretty much. And then Blade Runner was like this huge science fiction movie, really, you know, it was really like the first great sci-fi movie set in like a dirty technology overrun future. And Perfect Dark is, it's like the video game equivalent of what those two works were.
Yeah, and I mean, because of that, some people are going to disagree with, I think going to misunderstand my premise that it's the game to go forward on, because, you know, it does very much have that Blade Runner, the future is not very optimistic approach.
Right.
Which isn't new at all, obviously, if Blade Runner pioneered it, we're a hell of a long way from the release of Blade Runner. So, I mean, that's not a new thing now. But I think in a rare case of me saluting branding, it's got that outer shell and image potential that could assure it, you know, sales to see through actually doing something interesting with the game.
Yeah. I think what Perfect Dark was for video games was as pioneering as what Neuromancer and Blade Runner were for their respective mediums.
Right.
It may not have been as thoroughly polished as those two things were, because, I mean, video games are also so much younger. You know, so it's reasonable that it was like 20 years behind those two works. So, but yeah, like I totally agree with you that Blade Runner, given a good structure underneath, that really great outer shell could be really the horse to bet on.
Yeah, I see. And I think, yeah, if you could take the cultural legacy it draws on in its image and then mix that with the science and, you know, boundary pushing of a design approach like Valve has, you wouldn't necessarily know what to expect, but it would be a really good thing.
Yeah, and I think that's funny, like, having this come full circle as we were talking about Valve and Perfect Dark, is that Perfect Dark is sort of a game that is lacking exactly what Valve does best, you know?
Right.
Like, it is that armature and that great underneath design, at least that the second game was missing. The first one had a cruder version of it, because, you know, the hardware...
The first one very much had a template. But...
Yeah. So to see someone with the know-how and the desire to turn Perfect Dark into what it could and perhaps should be with an approach like Valve's would be very, very interesting to see.
I think we always come full circle, because we're just learning every day that all this stuff just ties into itself endlessly and loops around.
It's one of those things in nature.
Yeah, it's like running around in circles in Left 4 Dead.
Well, yeah, because we can't do that indefinitely, because you'll die. All right, then. So
So that is the first episode of Sugar Rush.
Yay.
So that's our responsibilities taken care of for another week. And, you know, maybe we'll do this again.
Yeah. So I guess if people have any suggestions or comments on the show, then definitely email us as well.
Yeah, that'd work. You know, direct all hate mail to Tucker, though. I really don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I feed off that stuff. I print it out and I lick the edges of the paper.
Yeah, well, you see, this will work out perfect then.
What's that? be sweet. Yes, I'm cooking for my son and his wife. It's his 30th birthday. 4 days into my bowl at the milk of 2 months ago. It's Mardi, Mom, isn't it? I don't give a flying fuck, bro.
Sweet.